So let me take you on a technical journey. I think this is more of a technical group than I usually get to talk to, so I tried to put a little bit more in here on this particular subject. If you look at fighters have been through a number of generations, and oftentimes we get the question, what does this fifth gen really mean? Well, fifth gen was a term that was coined maybe 10 years ago, and it's probably not really applicable now because people have come up with a 4.5 and a 4.8 and a 4.9, you know, so the differentiation margin has gotten smaller just through the marketing teams. But this is how sort of fighters evolved as you went through the early days of the program. It turns out that we built the SR-71 at Lockheed back in the early 60s, and while radar wasn't prolific then like it is now, and the airplane wasn't designed from a radar evasion perspective, its shaping and its materials allowed it to have a low cross-section. It has about the same radar cross-section as a B-1 that was built 25 years later for radar evasion purposes. So we were dabbling in stealth technology without really knowing about it back then. Then a requirement came out following the Vietnam War, or actually I think it was during the latter stages of it, to develop an airplane that was less susceptible to surface-to-air radars. It was a classified requirement. We were one of a number of companies that responded to that, and that resulted in sort of the thrust towards building the F-117 Nighthawk. Later on, we were able to take those faceted surfaces from the F-117, convert them into aerodynamic surfaces, more rounded surfaces, and with the B-2. The F-117 was an interesting requirement. Our Skunk Works developed the airplane, and they basically gave the operational requirement to electrical engineers. They said, you design an airplane that is invisible to radar or nearly invisible to radar. And they did, and it wouldn't fly. So they gave it then as a second step to the aeronautics engineers and said, now do the minimum changes to this that you have to do to make it fly. And that's why you have some of the strange early thinking and faceted surfaces on that airplane. As we went forward, then you can see how the fourth gen came along with, again, precision weapons, some off-bore sight capability. But then we were able to now recapture the full fighter characteristics, full maneuverability. And for anyone that is going to the air show, I think today and tomorrow are the 2 days that the F-22 is doing a flying display, and I encourage you to watch that. It's pretty neat. But these are the kind of characteristics that we've built into the airplane today. The stealth, 360-degree stealth around the airplane, full fighter performance. Our Air Force version of our airplane is a 9G airplane, just like an F-16 and an F-22. The Navy didn't require it. They wanted 7.5, so the Navy airplane is structurally built to 7.5 Gs, and the Marine Corps to 7. Probably more important than the aerodynamic performance is the sensor fusion that we're able to take to another level these days, and we do that through integrated sensor fusion. And a number of your folks, in fact, we just had a team in Fort Worth this past week. They got back last night, actually, looking at doing a deep dive into our sensor fusion and software. And then that opens up what we call net-enabled ops. When we started the program 10 years ago, net-enabled operations or net-ready didn't really have a definition to it. So our requirement was to be able to do an information exchange with 57 different specific platforms, okay, a P-3, a air warfare destroyer, you name it. That's since evolved into a new requirement that just says be net-ready. So trying to define what net-ready is and making sure you have all the interfaces is one of the technical challenges on the program. Now, this is some interesting things on this chart. This is some of the stuff that goes in the airplane. Is an integrated power pack, sometimes called a power thermal management system. On any earlier airplane, including the one we just finished, the F-22, that would be four separate systems on the airplane. For the first time, we've been able to generate an integrated vehicle management system. This is a turbine engine. It runs on its own gas-powered turbine until it starts the main engine. When it starts the main engine, it shifts over and runs off bleed air off the main engine. It's running all the time the airplane is flying in flight. It provides cooling liquid to the avionics. It provides air conditioning to the pilot. It's actually located back by the left vertical tail, and it provides air conditioning to the pilot in the cockpit. So if you think about weapons bays that you don't want to infringe on, and you think about a single engine routing, you know, cool air back and forth through the airplane fore to aft is another one of the packaging challenges that we've had. But this is what's called a power thermal management system. On the upper right, those are what we call electrohydrostatic actuators. We don't have a hydraulic system in this airplane like historic legacy airplanes have had. We have a small hydraulic accumulator at this control sensor right there, and it's about the size of your fist. okay, but the actuator itself runs on electrical power. So this is a more electric jet. It's 270 volt power that runs from the pilot's input on the stick back to the actuator at the flight control surface, and then it moves the surface. Now what you can see here is an interesting piece of the design of the airplane. On the far right is the Stovall actuator. This is a family of actuators. It's a 7G airplane, okay, so it has the lightest loads that have to be carried by the actuator. It's actually the smallest of the three. It's also much more weight sensitive on that airplane than the other two, although we try to maximize the commonality. The one in the middle is the Air Force version. That's a 9G airplane, so it has to push and pull a little bit harder to get those loads. And the one on the left is a Navy airplane. That's a bigger airplane with bigger flight control surfaces. Initially, we thought these actuators would scale up, but they don't. There's a squared or a cubed or a fourth power term in there somewhere. And so you can see it's substantially bigger than the other two. Now, these are all made by the same supplier who has an ecosystem under them, some of which is done here. We buy them as a group, and we install them. They're connecting points for the electrical and the different connections on the airplane are exactly the same. So as the airplane goes down a production line, the mechanic building the airplane knows no difference. It just knows one's a little bit bigger than the others. They install the same way. So the question is, how common are those actuators? Okay, we get no commonality credit because they're actually different. They have different part numbers. But almost everything in the process of buying them and installing them is common. So there is a level of commonality across those actuators, whether they're the same part number or not. That's been one of the ongoing discussions about the airplane. The HMDS helmet-mounted display system is taking that technology to a new height. Basically, we take whatever the pilot could historically see in the cockpit. It's now projected through projectors on his visor. One of the neatest things is we have six cameras that stare out around the airplane in the infrared spectrum, and they're there for missile warning to give the pilot an alert if there's a heat source coming towards them. But the imagery is so good that we can knit those six cameras together and map it to his helmet. So wherever he looks, he's actually looking through the camera. You can put a bag over your head, and you basically can fly the airplane with everything you're seeing through the cameras. You look down, you don't see your legs, you see everything under the airplane. It's quite interesting, actually, it's quite a leverage for situational awareness for pilots that are in the airplane. The last one I'll mention is the ejection seat, and I think I have a follow-on to that. This ejection seat is being cleared out to a higher speed, 550 knots. Today's ejection seats are basically 450. Smaller pilot population. We now designed this airplane to go from a 100-pound light female to a 250-pound big male, and you have to have an ejection system that will get the light person out safely without hurting them and not leave the big guy in the plane. So you can see sort of the challenges from a flight physiology standpoint. The biggest load is on the neck of a lightweight person. So we also have a slightly bigger helmet. It's about 1 pound heavier. About the same as the Jehimix, for those that know what that is, and about 1 pound heavier than just the shell. So we've had to develop a system on ejection that gives you an inflatable collar for the lightweight pilot, much like the NASCAR did after the death of Dale Earnhardt when he was killed in a race. But those are the kind of things that we're dealing with. So we really are pushing the state on some of the laws of physics and biology. We also have a series of surrogate test airplanes that we've been flying until we got the F-35 up and running. The one on the upper right is our flying test bed. That's a Boeing 737. We bought it from Lufthansa Airlines about 5 years ago. Took it out in the desert and made it into an F-35. It has an F-35 radar on the front. It's hard to see, but there's two little winglets that simulate the leading edge of the wing, so we have our EW antennas in there. The actual simulation of the layout of the airplane is exact to the detail of the 737. There's a cockpit right in about that area where a pilot comes in with his helmet on and his flight suit on, and he basically flies all the sensors using the JSF flight control system or central control system. Sitting behind him is the ultimate in backseat driving. He's got 20 engineers that break each of these systems out as individuals and watch everything he does. So we're able to take our software from the lab, then we take it to this airplane, and we sort of iron as much of it out as we can in a moving airborne environment, and then we go to the F-35 and put it into the full F-35 environment. A couple of other interesting things. This Bach 111 that you see there in the middle is a Northrop Grumman test bed. And to give you an idea of some of the sensor capability that we now have, that airplane has what's called the distributed aperture system, the camera system I was describing a minute ago, and the radar that goes on the airplane. And we're testing fusion software, which means when one sensor picks up a target, it'll slew the other sensors over there, and it'll prosecute that target till it gets all the information that it can. We were flying up off the coast of Baltimore, and we had a DAS hit, as they call it, a heat source that the DAS system picked up and tracked. And we tried to slew the radar over there and didn't pick anything up. So initially they thought it was a false target. When I went back and looked at the data, they found out that Cape Canaveral down in Florida had launched a satellite. And when it broke the horizon of the Earth, the DAS system picked it up, tracked it up to booster separation, and tracked it on into orbit. It was about 880 miles away. So, of course, the radar wasn't going to see it. But just a sense of what some of the power of some of these sensors are these days.